Welcome back to the Alternate Radio Hour. I am Joshua Holland, and my next guest truly needs no introduction. Noam Chomsky has been called the father of modern linguistics. He's a prolific author and one of America's best-known public intellectuals. Professor Chomsky, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks so much for coming on. Now, I want to talk to you about your new book, Occupy, and the issues it has raised. But before I get there, I want to just ask you about a few trends shaping our political discourse. I've read many, many of your books, and the one that I probably found the most influential was Manufacturing Consent. You wrote that, or you co-authored that, in the late 1980s, and since then we've seen some big changes. You know, the mainstream media has become far more consolidated since then. And at the same time, we've seen a huge proliferation of other forms of media. So we have the alternative media outlets, online outlets like Alternet, various social media. And looking at these trends, I wonder if you think that the range of what's considered to be acceptable discourse has widened or narrowed further.
Well, actually, we, Ed Herman and I had a second edition of that in about 10 years ago, and with a new long introduction. And at that time, we didn't really think that much had changed. If we were, I haven't talked to him about it, but if we were to do one now, we would certainly want to bring up what you've just mentioned. In my view, there have been, remember, we were talking about the mainstream media. Right. And with regard to them, I think the same, pretty much the same analysis holds, although my own feeling is that, say, since the 1960s, there has been some broadening and opening right through the mainstream, largely the effect of the activism of the 60s, which changed perceptions, attitudes, civilized the country in many ways, topics that are freely talked about today were invisible, and if visible, unmentionable 50 years ago. And furthermore, a lot of the journalists themselves are people who whose formation was in 60s activism or in its aftermath, which increased further. So these are changes that have been going on for a long time. Now, with regard to the alternative media, They certainly provide a wide range of options that wasn't there before. That includes access to foreign media. On the other hand, the internet is kind of like walking into the Library of Congress. In a sense, everything's there, but you have to know what you're looking for. If you don't know what you're looking for, you might as well not have the library. Like you can't decide you want to become a biologist. It's not enough to walk into the Harvard biology library. You have to have a framework of understanding. You have to a conception of what's important, what isn't important, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense. Not a rigid one that never gets modified, but at least some kind of framework. And unfortunately, that's pretty rare. We don't have, in the absence of activist movements that draw in a very substantial part of the population for interaction, interchange, the kinds of things that went on in the Occupy communities, for example, in the absence of that, most people are kind of like at sea when they face the internet. So yes, they can find things of value and significance, but you have to know, first of all, to look for them, and you have to have a kind of a framework of analysis and perception that allows you to weed that out from the a lot of the kind of junk that surrounds it.
Separating the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, basically. And that does require a fundamental organized activism. That's the kind of thing you have to do with other people. You have to be able to try out ideas, get reactions, sharpen your perceptions, start looking further in ways that are constructive. And that really doesn't take place without substantial organization. Now, there is interchange over the internet, but it's necessarily tends to be kind of on the superficial side.
That may be an understatement, looking at the comments on our website anyway. Let's turn to your new book on the Occupy movement. It's called Occupy, and folks, it's a quick and really good read. It's available on alternet.org as well. You can just click over to the home site, and you shouldn't have any trouble finding it. Professor, you do a good job of explaining the class war that's been waged from above by our economic elites over these past 30 or 40 years. And, you know, privation is relative. Americans living at the poverty line still have a greater amount of wealth than 80% or 90% of the world's population. And given that very few people are actually starving in this country, and these economic trends go so far back, what do you think the tipping point was? What set off this movement? Was it just the severity of the Great Recession, or do you think something else helped open people's eyes?
Well, you're certainly right that we're better off than most of the world. In fact, just before talking to you, I happened to be talking to a wonderful woman from India who's been working for many years and living in villages in one of the poorest areas in India, describing their activities and successes and failures and so on. And of course, that's a radically different world. But people here or anywhere don't compare themselves with the Stone Age. They compare themselves with what ought to be available for a decent life in the kind of society they live in. I mean, this is the richest, most powerful country in world history. It has extraordinary advantages, and comparing what ought to be, given those circumstances, with what is for the large majority of the population, you know, the 99% in the imagery of the Occupy movement, well, that's a huge gap. And it's even an absolute gap. So, for example, we don't have the kind of health care that comparable societies have. We don't have the kind of infrastructure. The last 30-odd years, there's been, even apart from the last recession, there's been relative stagnation for the large majority of the population. Actually, what's actually happened is captured pretty nicely in a small book that came out, I think, after the publication of the one that you're referring to, so I didn't mention it. But there's a recent publication by the Economic Policy Institute, which has been the main source of reliable data on the state of working America, which means almost everyone, for about 30, 35 years. And it's called Failure by Design. And both terms are, it's an easy read and worth reading. But the title is quite accurate. It's failure in the sense that for the large majority of the population, there has been essentially no progress, even though there's been substantial wealth produced, and the economy itself is far less productive than it ought to be. Here I mean production for use, production for what people need, far less so in social services and manufacturing and so on. It's, of course, been a spectacular success for a tiny percentage of the population. You know, a tenth of 1% knocks the distribution kind of way off the international spectrum. So it's a class-based failure, and it's by design. That's the crucial fact. There have been and still are other options available. Things don't have to happen like this. And I think there's just been a steady buildup of concern, anger, frustration. You can see it in polls, hatred of institutions, distrust. It's all over the country, and it's been rising for a long time. And the Occupy movement managed to capture the mood and crystallize it. I mean, and that's the way popular movements take off, like, say, take the civil rights movement. I mean, the civil rights movement itself went on for decades, but a few things did lead to substantial growth and development, like, you know, Rosa Parks or the black students sitting in at lunch counters in Greensboro, North Carolina. A couple of things happen. They draw in others. All of a sudden, pretty soon, you get a big popular movement. The same things happened with the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, the global justice movement, and Occupy came along at a time which was ripe. And the strategy, I thought, was brilliant. And if I had been asked, I wouldn't have advised it. My judgment would have been it's never going to work, but I was totally wrong, fortunately. Worked very well. A lot of two major developments took place, I think. And if they can be sustained, it'll be, and expanded, it'll be of extreme importance. One was just kind of changing the discourse, putting things on the public agenda that were simmering in the background, but were never articulated in a focused fashion, like inequality or financial shenanigans and corruption, or you know, the shredding of the democratic system, and the collapse of a productive economy, things like that. These things just became common coin. That's very important. The other thing that happened, which is a little hard to measure, is the creation of communities. So the Occupy communities, which were, I thought, extremely valuable. These were communities of that just kind of spontaneously developed of mutual support, public interchange, the kinds of things that are very much lacking in a atomized society like ours, where people are kind of alone. You know, the social unit that the business world strives for is a dyad, a pair, you and your television set or your computer screen. And that was broken by the Occupy movement in a very significant way. And just the possibilities of cooperation, solidarity, mutual support, public discussion, democratic participation. That's a kind of a model which is should inspire people, not only the participants, direct participants, and a lot of people did participate, at least peripherally, but others as well. Well, if these two developments can be sustained and extended, there could be a real long-term impact. It's not going to be easy, but there's major challenges, but you know, tactics will have to be readjusted, as always. But it was a real breakthrough. I mean, if you think what's happened in just a few months, it's quite startling.
If you're just joining us, this is Joshua Holland, and I'm talking to Noam Chomsky. Now, I want to shift gears a little bit for a moment. You've had a lot to say and write about the so-called Arab Spring. And it seems that this so-called awakening has been somewhat uneven, as has the United States government's reaction to it in various countries. So we had the specter of the U.S. government somewhat hesitantly backing the revolution in Egypt, but using force in Libya, and at the same time turning a blind eye as Saudi Arabia and other forces defended the regime in Bahrain, a move that oddly put the U.S. and Iranian governments on the same page. How should we understand these seeming contradictions or uneven developments?
Well, first of all, I think U.S. policy has been quite consistent. And that's also true of France, England. France is quite influential in the western part of northern Africa and West Africa. So Tunisia was a kind of like a French protectorate. The French, the traditional imperial powers, have had a very consistent position, namely opposition to democratizing tendencies in the region, anywhere. So you say the U.S. hesitantly supported the overthrow of dictatorship in Egypt. Well, that's sort of true. But what actually happened, I think, is a very traditional pattern. It happens over and over again that the favored dictator totters and faces it becomes harder and harder to sustain him. In fact, maybe ultimately the army turns against him. Well, in such cases, and there are probably dozens of them, Somoza, Marcos, Suharto, Mobutu, you know, just happens over and over again. What you do, there's a kind of a game plan, which is followed routinely. Support the dictator and the regime as long as possible. When it becomes impossible, for example, if the army turns against him, which is what happened in Egypt, then send him out to pasture, issue ringing statements about your love of democracy, and then try to restore as much of the old regime as possible. And that's pretty much what's happening. The major success story so far actually is Tunisia. The French supported the dictatorship well into the time when the uprising was, you know, it was massive, but they continued to support him. Then they finally kind of backed off. There has been a real popular participation in Tunisia, which has changed things. And they got plenty of problems, but there's been considerable progress. Egypt, which is the most important country, where quite exciting things happened. It's a lot of it has just been beaten back. The regime is pretty much in place. The groups that were the Islamic groups, which were organizing under the dictatorship, they're officially outlawed, persecuted, but they were organizing urban slums or rural areas, and that large organizational structure has allowed them, particularly the Brotherhood, but also the Salafis, to gain dominant influence in whatever kind of formal dramatic space there is. The U.S. can live with them. The Muslim Brotherhood leadership is neoliberal. It basically accepts, you know, the framework of U.S. global policies. The U.S. has no objection to Islamic rule. That's a joke. Saudi Arabia, which is the main ally, is the most extreme Islamic fundamentalist state in the world and one of the most repressive. The U.S. has no problem with that. You know, you can be Islamic or anything else as long as you accept the basic structure of U.S. global power, U.S. and its allies. And the Brotherhood would very likely go along with that pretty much, not entirely. And there's no time to go through it case by case, but I think if you look, you'll find that every case is essentially the same in that the U.S. and its imperial allies are strongly, very much fear actual democratic progress, and they want to block it. And there's a very simple reason for that. Just take a look at the polls. There's extensive polling, Western U.S. polling, polling by reputable Arab organizations, the most recent one in Doha, and they give about the same results, and they've been giving it for some time. So it turns out that throughout the region, what people see as the major threat that they face by an overwhelming margin is the United States and Israel. They don't like Iran. Iran is quite unpopular. That goes way back to, you know, Persian Arab tensions, Shia Sunni tensions go way back. So Iran's unpopular, but very few regard Iran as a threat. In the latest poll, it's a couple of weeks ago, it was about 5%. Opposition to U.S. policy is so strong that a majority, often in some places a large majority, thinks the region would be better off if Iran had nuclear weapons. They don't want nuclear weapons, but just to offset U.S.-Israeli power. A recent Gallup poll in Egypt just a couple of weeks ago found that over 80% of Egyptians want to reject U.S. aid because of opposition to the United States and fear of the threats that it poses. Well, you know, just without continuing, those are not the policies that the United States and its allies want to see instituted, obviously. But if, to the extent that you have a functioning democracy, public opinion influences policy.
Right.
So naturally they're opposed to democracy. You don't read that in the media and the journals. You talk about our love for democracy and so on, and about inconsistency, why here, not there. There's very little inconsistency. There hasn't been, you know, as far back as you go. And in fact, that's recognized by the more serious scholarship, which does recognize kind of ruefully that the United States supports democracy insofar as it conforms to strategic and economic objectives. It's true in Latin America, it's true in the Middle East, true everywhere, it's true at home for that matter, and it's completely understandable. We shouldn't have any illusions about it. Now, that's not what the people in the United States may want, but here, as in other countries, popular opinion and public policy are often separated by a chasm, a mark of the lack of functioning democracy. And in fact, one of the reasons, to get back to home, why there's such enormous antagonism to political institutions. Approval of Congress is in single digits. I don't think it's ever been that low.
Right, 11% in a recent poll.
Yeah, 11%, something like that. Yeah, it's practically invisible.
Yeah.
You know? And the same is true of institutions across the board. The corporations, banks, science, why should we believe the pointy-headed scientists, a lot of things.
Only the military still scores well in terms of people's trust in institutions. They still trust the military.
Yeah, but that's right. And that's none of this is terribly healthy, I should say. In fact, it's dangerous. But it does reflect the basically the shredding of functioning democracy, which has been going on for a long time, but it's just, to get back to why things are happening now, just in the last election and the present election, the fact that elections are essentially bought has become so evident that it's hard to miss, you know?
Now, Professor, we have very, very little time, and I know that you have other engagements, so I want to let you go. But let me ask a final question. Talking about all of these trends internationally, what do you make of the increasingly prevalent view that the U.S. is, in fact, an empire in decline? You know, on the one hand, it certainly does seem that our so-called soft power is waning, but then one has to contrast that with our increasing military dominance in the post-Cold War era, and especially in the wake of 9/11. Are we really in decline?
Yeah, we're in decline, and the United States has been in decline since 1945. It's 1945, end of the Second World War. The United States was in a position of just phenomenal power. It had half of the world's wealth. It had total security. It controlled the Western Hemisphere, both oceans, opposite sides of both oceans. It had very ambitious aims to control most of the world and ensure no objections to its rule anywhere. These were quite explicit, and they were largely implemented. But it began to decline very fast. In 1949, an event took place which is called here the loss of China. So we lost China somehow. Namely, they became independent. And that's been a huge source of controversy and conflict in the United States ever since. Who's responsible for the loss of China? Shortly after that came concern about the loss of Indochina, which didn't matter that much in itself, but there was concern that it would spread to the loss of Southeast Asia. The concept loss is kind of interesting. It's sort of the tacit assumption this is basically ours. And that's gone on over the years. By 1970, U.S. share of world wealth was down to about 25%, which is still colossal, but not 50%. And the world was already becoming more diverse. in the last, just don't go through the whole story, but in the last decade, South America has moved to substantial independence. Actually, we just saw that in the Cartagena conference in Colombia, the Western Hemisphere conference in Colombia, where the United States was isolated. And there were the positions on the major issues, drugs, Cuba, and so on. The U.S. was just isolated. Well, that's a sign of significant loss of power and influence. And now it's happening in the Middle East. That's another reason why the U.S. and its allies are so worried about the threat of democracy and independence and so eager to try to maintain regimes that will conform in some way. You're right that military power hasn't declined. In fact, relative to the rest of the world, may even have increased. The U.S. has close to half the world's military expenditures, the only country with hundreds of bases everywhere, ability to project power everywhere, new technology of destruction and murder, and drones, for example. It's way ahead of the rest of the world in any of this space as well. But the question that you brought up, so-called soft power, and that's important. The capacity to influence has continued to decline, as it has been, as has been happening since 1945. Actually, one index of it is vetoes at the United Nations. Till the mid-60s, the world was so much under U.S. control that the U.S. didn't veto a single resolution at the Security Council. Since the mid-60s, the United States is far in the lead in vetoing Security Council resolutions. Britain, which is a client state, is second, and no one else is even close. Well, that's another reflection of the decline in capacity, in power, meaning in ability to influence and control. So it's a steady, part of this decline is self-inflicted. So what Economic Policy Institute calls failure by design, correctly calls it that, a class-based failure by design, that has significantly weakened the United States. And that will continue unless, you know, there's significant real changes here, the changes that would benefit the population and, in fact, the world. But, yeah, that's a steady course of decline. There's a kind of a corollary that's very standard. China's taking over. That we should be cautious about. Chinese growth has been spectacular, but it could well be. First of all, China remains a very poor country, incomparably poorer than the United States. It hasn't, it has grown as a huge manufacturing center, but mainly for assembly. It's basically an assembly plant for, for the sophisticated industrial countries on its periphery and Western multinationals like Apple and Dell and so on. That'll change over time, but it's a long haul. And China faces real problems, ecological problems, demographic problems, many others. So it's significant development, but a lot of the hype about it, I think one should be kind of skeptical about. So yeah, these processes are underway, undoubtedly. They're partly by design. There are plenty of, there is a sector that's doing fantastically well, mainly financial capital. But for the general public in the world scene, it's a different story. That's why you have uprisings all over. I'm afraid I've got to go off. I've got an international video conference coming, so I can't delay them.
Yeah. Noam Chomsky, thank you so much for joining us and taking the time. Sorry I kept you too long.
No, that's okay. Glad to talk to you.
And folks, bye. Pick up his book. It's called Occupy, and you can get it at alternet.org.